the 14th chapter of the book of Acts, when Paul and Barnabas were making their return on their first preaching journey. The 23rd verse of that recording, Luke says that they were appointing elders in every church. These were not old churches. These were young churches. They were conscientiously making that decision that those churches might have what the Bible calls elders. And so it was God's plan, as churches reach that level of maturity, that they have men among them designated as elders. What are they for? In the 20th chapter of the book of Acts, the Apostle Paul is having an elders' class. He's called to him the elders of the church at Ephesus, and he's discussing with them their work. And in the 28th verse, Luke records that he told them to be on guard for yourselves and for all the flock among which the Holy Spirit has made you overseers, to shepherd the church of God which he purchased with his own blood. We just sang about victory in Jesus. We just sang how he plunged us in the cleansing flood. The work of elders is related to that. It's people who have enjoyed the cleansing blood of Christ that they're to oversee and to help them to continue to enjoy that saving relationship with Jesus Christ. In the context, you see in verse 29 following, this particular church would be threatened with those who would come in like grievous wolves and draw away disciples after them. We learn in a later letter to the church at Ephesus, found in the book of Revelation, that there were those who claimed to be apostles and were not. They were able to expose them and stand against them, and possibly these elders had a force in doing that very thing. And so elders striving to guard God's people against those who would come in and deceive them and lead them astray from their master and Lord. That's the work of these men we call elders or bishops or overseers. In 1 Peter chapter 5, Peter writes to brethren, and he particularly in the first part of chapter 5 addresses the men we are discussing tonight, elders. You'll note in verse 1, he says that he is a fellow elder and witness of the sufferings of Christ and a partaker of the glory that is to be revealed. And he says, shepherd the flock of God among you, exercising oversight, not under compulsion, but voluntarily, according to the will of God, not for sordid gain, but with eagerness, nor yet as lording it over those allotted to your charge, but proving to be examples to the flock. So these people have been entrusted to these men. They've been allotted to their charge. And they had the responsibility to see about their welfare. Whereas when Paul was addressing the Ephesian elders, he mentioned the danger of these people coming in and leading them astray like savage wolves. 1 Peter is a book that's dealing with the sufferings of life, the difficulties of living godly in an ungodly world, the difficulty of being an island on a sea of unbelief. And people get discouraged, and people can be sucked in by these things. These people had left that lifestyle. What is the work of elders? To help these people remain true, to be holy people, to endure the sufferings of life. And as Rod pointed out when he taught 1 Peter, to help them to have that living hope that will enable them to sustain the faith that they confessed when they became Christians. And so God, in his wonderful love and grace, intended that each local church have men called elders or bishops or presbyters or pastors. And all of these terms are synonymous, talking about the same men, just different facets of their either qualifications or work. Now, you'll note in these two passages, there's a very, very important little phrase. Do not overlook it. If you're still at 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 2, you'll see that he encourages these men in the various churches to which this might go. And he says to shepherd the flock of God among you. Among you. The little word that's translated among, your version may translate it differently, but most of the major versions will either translate among or in. And it's a word that carried that idea. The flock among you, in your midst. It would be the flock in which they have fellowship. The whole concept of a local church is Christians that have banded together for fellowship, for working and worshiping together. And since elders were put in each local church, the flock among them would be that group of disciples. Among them, you have a similar phrase in Acts 20, 28. In this version, the New American Standard, the 95 edition, says that they are to be on guard for all the flock among which. Yours may say in the which. It may say, I think the King James says, over the which. Translated differently, but it's the same idea. The particular local church of which they are members. Now, that's going to form the focus of our study. There's a number of ways we could obviously approach the study of elders, but we're going to be looking at one particular facet, and that is that their oversight. Listen to this. I'm going to say it many times tonight. Is based on the relationship they sustain to that local church of which they are members and overseers. Furthermore, their oversight arises from that relationship and is defined by that relationship. Now, their oversight primarily is spiritual, having to do with these people's souls. That's contrary to what is often the practice in churches throughout the land. Elders are appointed to decide how the funds are spent. Elders do have jurisdiction in funds, but it is not their primary work. It is really a secondary focus of their work. And yet sometimes the apostasy is often in this secondary field. But how would you approach discussing this with someone? How would you go about showing that God's plan of government is local and that there is no church-wide oversight? There is no oversight between religious groups. We're going to approach it this way tonight. It seems to me, at least, to be a simple, a clear approach, something that we can all understand. I hope that you will agree with that and maybe can use this in your further studies or teaching others. This principle that I've introduced, and the principle is simply a fundamental truth, something that is obvious or axiomatic. This principle that duties are, in our case, we're studying a particular kind of duty, authority, the right to rule. Elders do have the right to rule. They're called bishops or overseers. They are not legislators. Christ is the head over all things to the church, Ephesians 1, 22 and 23. They do not have the right to ask people to do anything that violates the will of God. Acts 5:29, Peter said we must obey God rather than men. But they do have jurisdiction. They do have oversight. But their oversight, their authority, is based upon the relationship they sustain to that local church. It arises from the relationship and is defined by it. Now, maybe you have not used that terminology, but you understand it. Look at Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 4. We'll just give a couple simple illustrations, ones that are so obvious that you will clearly see the truth of this principle. While this statement is not found that I have made, it underlies the truth of these passages, and you will readily agree with that. In Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 4, he says, "Fathers, do not provoke your children to anger, but bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord." Which children are fathers to bring up? And who has the responsibility to bring up children? obviously we understand that when he says, fathers, bring up your children, he's talking about the children to whom they sustain a relationship to as father. If this is written to Christians, isn't it? To the church at Ephesus. If in the church at Ephesus, someone reads this, but they do not have a child, there's James Airy and Jacob Airy sitting back there. Are they to bring up their children? They don't have any. The duty is based on the relationship. It arises from the relationship. Without the relationship, there is no duty, this particular duty. So it's not a Christian duty, it's the duty of Christians, but it's the duty of fathers, not to children, but to their children. Likewise, though they are fathers and though they are children, they do not have this duty over other people's children. If one of the fathers in this audience was to take someone else's child and began to discipline them, they may say, oh, wait a minute, what are you doing? Who gave you that right? What does right mean? Authority. He might say, I'm a father, and that's a child. And Ephesians 6:4 says, fathers are to train children. You'd say, but wait a minute, that's not your child. And while you may not use the terminology I'm using tonight, what you're appealing to is this principle. Your authority arises out of the relationship that you sustain to a particular child, and it's also limited or defined by that relationship. We understand that. But, if that child is a member of this other fellow's Boy Scout troop, let's say, or he works for this fellow on the weekends or in the evenings. Now, does that man have any authority at all over that child? Yes. Not because he's a father, but because he's a Boy Scout director or an employer. The duty or the authority arises from the relationship and is defined by it. If he works for this man as an employee, his authority over that boy is defined by that relationship. He does not have the right to enter the domestic relationship and there exercise authority over that son. We understand that, do we not? Look at another passage. Look at Colossians chapter 3. Colossians chapter 3. Look at verse 18. You're aware of the fact, are you not, that there is no separate word for woman and wives in your New Testament. Our Bibles translate them differently, but it's really the same word. The reason they will use wives in one place and women in another is contextual. I'm not arguing with that. It's good. I just want you to be aware that what Paul literally wrote here is women be subject to your husbands. To your men, really, to your men. Women, be subject to your men. Which woman to which man? You say, well, the one that she sustained a relationship to as a wife. The duty or the husband's authority grows out of the relationship. And it's also defined by that relationship. A husband does not have the right over any woman who is a wife, but over his wife. Being a husband does not give him general authority. The duty arises from the relationship and is defined by the relationship. But should your wife work for some other man, he would have authority over her based on the employer-employee relationship and defined by that relationship. We don't have to go through this process of reasoning every day. We just understand that. And this principle underlies so many things in the Bible. The government-citizen relationship. Which government are you to obey? Britain or the United States? The one you sustain a relationship to, right? The same thing is true with employer-employee relationship. The employer has the right over his employee. And his authority is defined by that relationship. Now, in the two passages we have referred to, if there's two passages you either need to have in the back of your mind for ready recall, or write them in the back or front of your Bible somewhere, it's these two passages that we've talked about. Acts 20, 28, 1 Peter 5, 2. If you want to talk to somebody about the government of God's people, what has God set up for his people? These are the two passages you certainly need to be aware of. In both passages, he says that they are to shepherd the flock among which, in the which, over the which, depending on what your version says. And I checked all the major versions, the King James, the New King James, the New American Standard, the English Standard Version, all of the major versions translate it this way. So we know that's a good, stable way, a good foundational way in which to translate that term that is used. Because their elders or overseers does not give them authority over any other church. Their authority arises from the relationship to the local church and is defined by, circumscribed by, the relationship they sustain to that local church, whether you're talking about spiritual oversight or whether you're talking about the oversight of the funds. It begins and ends with that relationship. When you talk about elders and their work, there's not a whole lot in the Bible about elders and their work with money, with funds. There's a little bit, but not a whole lot. In the 11th chapter of the book of Acts, there's a famine that's announced by prophet Agabus, verse 28, and the brethren decided to have a part in striving to relieve that. And so in verse 29 it says, in the proportion that any of the disciples had means, each of them determined to send a contribution for the relief of the brethren living in Judea. Now note they sent it for the brethren. And this they did, sending it in charge of Barnabas and Saul to the elders. In Judea were a number of churches. In those churches there might be needy people. We don't have a whole lot more information. But if there were 3 churches or 6 churches or 10 churches in Judea with people in need, and the text says they sent it to the elders. Which elders? If our principle is correct, we know the answer. They sent it to the elders of the churches where the needy people were, so they could oversee the distribution of the funds of the flock among them. Among which? In the which? Elders have jurisdiction, listen carefully, over funds for the flock of which they're members. That's what you have here. And they have jurisdiction over funds from the flock of which they're members. Look at Philippians chapter 1. Here's a letter to the church at Philippi. This church has elders or overseers. He mentions that in chapter 1, verse 1. To all the saints in Christ Jesus are in Philippi, including the overseers and deacons. When you get to chapter 4, you see that this church made a contribution, funds if you please, to support the apostle Paul. And in Philippians 4:15, he says, you yourselves also know, Philippians, so that's the Christians, when this fund was made, the Christians in that church had a share in it. That at the first preaching of the gospel, after I left Macedonia, no church shared with me in the matter of giving and receiving, but you alone. For even in Thessalonica, you sent a gift more than once for my needs. So here are funds from the church at Philippi. Who has any jurisdiction about where those funds go? There are elders in Jerusalem. We know that from Acts 15. There are elders in Thessalonica. We know that from 1 Thessalonians 5. Which elders have jurisdiction over these funds? It's the elders of the church from which those funds are collected and sent. So when you talk about funds, here's the principle. Their authority is based on the relationship they sustain to the local church, and they have oversight over funds for that local church or from that local church. If our principle is correct, that makes that very clear, and that circumscribes, that defines their relationship. That's all the authority they have. Now let's spend a few minutes talking about violations of this pattern and this principle that we have been observing. The most obvious violation, and I think most of this audience understands this, would be for God's people to have universal oversight. That is, for there to be a man or a group of men, and both are practiced in the religious world today, that claim to have authority over God's people worldwide, over their spiritual welfare, and over their funds that are collected for spiritual purposes or to relieve the needy. So how do you know that's not true? The same way I know, that there should not be Coca-Cola on that table. Not because it says thou shalt not have Coca-Cola, but God has specified the elements to be used in the memorial. And God has specified the basis upon which these men have oversight and the extent of it. And there's nothing in the New Testament about any kind of universal oversight. Scaling down a bit, a widespread practice in the religious world is not universal oversight, but denominational oversight. I know the word denomination can be used to group people who share a common belief. But another use of that word is to group churches who work under a common oversight. For example, the Southern Baptist denomination is a collection or a collectivity of churches, Baptist churches, not all Baptist churches, but Baptist churches who work under, at least to some degree, the oversight of the Southern Baptist Convention. And whatever denomination you talk about, most of them, I'm not going to say all of them, most of them have some kind of oversight over churches, plural. And those who are a part of that oversight form that denomination. You just won't read about it in the New Testament. Well, if we don't read about it, does it mean it's okay? It might if there were no specific instructions about oversight. But there is. Do you know where to find them? Two passages. And you can include Acts 14:23 if you wish, because there were elders in every church. And these elders' oversight was based upon the relationship they sustained to that local group. So if we're going to follow the New Testament as our pattern, universal oversight or denominational wide oversight is simply not authorized. But There are many in churches of Christ across this land who would agree with what I've just said. But here comes the rub. They would agree that those kinds of arrangements are wrong, but they believe that men who are called elders can oversee funds and work and people who are not part of the group of which they are members. Funds neither for their group nor from their group, but rather funds that have been contributed maybe by several churches for a general work. You say, what's wrong with that? The Bible talks about elders, and elders oversee money. The Bible talks about fathers overseeing children. Would you agree for your children and your grandchildren to be under my oversight and let me spank them? Oh, no, no. Well, I'm a father. He said, not of my children. Exactly. You know, you could, let's suppose I say, brethren, I need $10,000 a month to take care of my children. What children? Well, I've just assumed the oversight of a number of children. I'm calling them my children, and I'm going to be their father. You say, you can assume it all you want to. You don't have that relationship. And that's deceptive labeling. I may set up an organization and become the president of it and now solicit funds from people to help me run it. That's a different thing. And when men function over something else than the church of which they are members, you can call them elders. You can call them sponsoring elders, but they're not functioning as the elders you read about in the Bible. And that's what's going on among many churches of Christ today. There are churches where the elders are receiving funds from 500, 1,000, maybe more churches. It's not for their group. Is not from their group. But they have assumed the oversight of it and continue to ask for more. What's wrong with it? Same thing that's wrong with Coca-Cola on that table. That's what's wrong with it. God has a plan and the elements to be used in worship. And God has a plan for the oversight of His people. Two verses, Acts 20:28. 1 Peter 5:2, along with Acts 14:23, elders in every church, their oversight is limited to, circumscribed by, begins and ends with the relationship they sustain to a local church. Even when you talk about spiritual relationships, elders in this congregation sustain no relationship to other Christians as elders. That is, Christians outside of this group. If I want to talk to somebody outside this group about their soul as a fellow Christian, that's one thing. But not as an elder. My role, Wally's role, and Rod's role as spiritual overseers begins and ends with this local church. Now, people may mean well. The universal oversight that derived over centuries of development, maybe it had a good purpose, and likewise with denominational oversight. But the fact is, it's simply not biblical. So besides the fact that there are no such thing as brotherhood elders or churchhood elders, there is no such thing. Likewise, there is no authority for someone other than elders dictating the work and ruling local churches. You say, what are you talking about? Preachers sometimes, in their zeal for people's souls and for doing the work, this is, I think, especially difficult with men who have worked with small, struggling churches, it would be so difficult for them to avoid assuming that role. They get to where everybody looks to them for direction and instruction and decision making, and somebody's not living right, preacher. He is a preacher. He is not a bishop. He is not an overseer. And because he happens to be the man with knowledge, maybe he takes some leadership, but he's still not the overseer. And preachers, again, in their zeal, had dictated, wanting to dictate to churches about how they worship, who they support, various other facets of their local work, who they ought to withdraw from. There are preachers that will send out letters telling churches who they ought to withdraw from. That's none of their business. Papers. There are churches ruled by papers. Papers have been very powerful among brethren. Papers have done a lot of good. But sometimes churches are ruled, maybe not by in writing, but by the influence of this paper, whether they'd approve of the things that are being done. Colleges. When I was living in Oklahoma, I audited some Greek courses while I was there, so I got to be around some of the young men who were going to a so-called Christian college, Oklahoma Christian College. And what would happen is these young boys would preach in the churches in the area. Nothing wrong with that. But here's the question. How much influence did that college begin to have in those churches and what they taught and what was orthodox and what was right? Especially when these young boys had been taught by these professors who were supposed to be exceptionally good Bible students, and some of them were good Bible students, although I certainly differed with them on the sponsoring church arrangement, for example. Colleges have no right to dictate to churches what they ought to believe, how their worship ought to be conducted. In fact, God didn't set up a secular college to even train preachers. He already has a college to do that. It's called the local church. But nevertheless, these are some of the things we get into, maybe in zeal, but if we can just remember this basic principle: no relationship, no authority. How important is this anyway? You know, I've told you, and you know, if you've been here very long, that I struggle with what to preach, what's needed, what will be good, what will be beneficial. Here we are on Sunday night. You've chosen to come back, which I appreciate so very much. Is this lesson worth your 40 minutes that we spend on it? Over in 1 Samuel chapter 15, you remember Saul, the king? And you remember how God had told him to go and destroy the Amalekites? You remember that Saul was the head man in the kingdom. In verse 17, when Samuel met him on his way back, he said, "Is it not true that you were little in your own eyes, and you were made the head of the tribes of Israel, and the Lord anointed you king over Israel, and the Lord sent you on a mission?" Every bit of authority that men have is delegated. That's what this word delegate means, to be entrusted with for a mission, to be entrusted with. And he says, God delegated you king. So you are answerable to God for your use of your authority as king. And he says, God told you to go and destroy the sinners, the Amalekites, and fight against them until they're exterminated. Why then did you not obey the voice of the Lord, but rushed upon the spoil and did what was evil in the sight of the Lord? And that famous passage was born that you read about in verse 22, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to hearken than the fat of rams. That famous passage is born out of a context of an abuse of authority, an overextension of delegated authority. It echoed through the rest of the Old Testament in application to other areas. You cannot substitute for what God has said. But can you see that God held this king responsible for the use or misuse of the rightful authority of king when he overextended that for whatever reasons he may have thought that justified it. In 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 4, when Peter writes to these elders, he says, verse 4, when the chief shepherd appears, you'll receive the unfading crown of glory. So these men are, as it were, under shepherds, under the chief shepherd. And they will give account how they have carried out their responsibility, whether they've failed to take care of the flock among them, or they've extended themselves beyond the scope of the authority that they were delegated. I don't want to meet the chief shepherd with that responsibility of having overstepped or failed in my responsibility as a shepherd of God's people. If you're familiar with religious history, you know that apostasy has a history of originating among the government of God's people. Back in the Old Testament, the time of Samuel, it originated in the government when the people said, we don't want judges, we want a king. You're aware of the fact in the first 600 years of the early church history, there was a departure from God's plan of men in a congregation with equal oversight, where one man became the presiding elder, and then one man in an area became the presiding elder over those group of men, and finally, within 600 years, one man became the universal ruler. Took 600 years to reach its peak. In the 19th century, there was again an apostasy. In the 20th century, another apostasy. And time after time after time, it has to do with this area. We need to be informed. We need to teach our young people who are growing up. They need to know why elders' authority is based upon the relationship with the church that they are members. It arises from it and is defined by it. I'm preaching this lesson tonight. But what is your responsibility? Some of you in this audience may someday move, would like for you to stay here. But you may move, job move. Some of you young people may move off to go to college and get married. You're going to have a responsibility. 1 Thessalonians chapter 5 says, examine all things or test all things. And then turn away from what is evil and hold to what is good. That's a doctrinal passage. That's your responsibility. When you choose a group to worship with, are you equipped to examine whether or not they're following the New Testament pattern? I want to finish with a verse from 1 Samuel chapter 8. This verse underscores the importance of respecting God's plan for governing His people. Samuel, you remember, had gotten old and his sons had become judges and they were wicked. That's one of the sad things. So many times men who ought to be the rightful rulers are corrupt and they fail. And instead of restoring God's plan, they looked around at the nations about them and said, we want a king to judge us like the other nations. In 1 Samuel 8:7, the Lord said to Samuel, listen to the voice of the people in regard to all that they say to you. For they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from being king over them. And if you're familiar with that figure of speech, the not but construction, you know they had rejected Samuel, but that was not the important thing. They had rejected God when they rejected His plan for their government. And when we reject God's plan for the government of His people today, it's a rejection of Almighty God.